say, watch out.
It's everything I can do to keep from just keeping on with that song and singing. I could sing to all y'all out there. That is Shane McGowan and Friends with a very special cover of Screamin' Jay Hawkins, I Put a Spell on You. And the friends include Johnny Depp, Nick Cave, Mick Jones, Eliza Doolittle, Chrissy Hynde, just a whole barrel full of people. Just an amazing, amazing collection of people who put this out as a benefit, as a fundraiser for Haiti. And so if you want to check that out, you just Google Shane McGowan from the Pogues and Shane McGowan and Friends, and you'll come up on it. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm Michael Slate, and today's show is going to move really, really, really. It's going to be hard-hitting and fast. It's one of those shows that's got to be hard-hitting and fast, and at the same time, you know that that holds the potential for many things going wrong and everything getting mixed up, so there's a real edge of anxiety on my part. In the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Age from the October 22nd Coalition and the Los Angeles Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant, and Jack Bryson, a friend of the Oscar Grant family, whose sons were on the platform with Oscar when he was murdered. And we'll be talking about the upcoming protests and what the new developments, the developments in the Oscar Grant case, the trial of the murderer, Johannes Messerli. Before that, we'll be talking with Clyde Young from the Revolution Newspaper and Revolutionary Communist Party on the heartless and illegal banning of Revolution Newspaper by authorities at California's Pelican Bay State Prison and Menard Prison in Illinois. And opening up the show is something I've been waiting for quite some time. We keep talking about it being a monthly column, and we've yet to be able to get it to be regular, for usually it's my fault. I'm very, very happy to welcome back to the show P.Z. Myers, associate biology professor at the University of Minnesota Morris, author of the world's most popular science blog, Pharyngula, and he's also just come back from what apparently was one of the largest global gatherings of godless heathens in history. P.Z., how are you?
Very good. Glad to be with you.
Yeah. So you were at this Global Atheist Convention.
Correct.
And from everything I read about it, it seemed, one, there was just so much that seemed pretty exciting about it, but I was just wondering, they kept saying that this is the, you know, largest gathering in Australian history. It seemed to be a huge gathering in any case for anywhere. When one of the themes of this was also the rise of atheism. Is this a significant leap around the rise of atheism in the world?
Well, you know, I think it's a progressive thing. We're gradually getting bigger and bigger, and this was the biggest meeting ever so far, but I bet you the next one will be even larger. Mm-hmm. That what we're seeing is this worldwide rise in attention being given to atheism, and more atheists coming out of the closet. And this was just a case where it was right at the right time, in a very strange place. It's very far away from everything, but we got this huge crowd of Australians. We've got all these people from the UK and the United States coming over. It just got gigantic, much, much bigger than they had expected. And they actually had to turn people away who wanted to come.
Yeah, you know, I was reading in one newspaper account where they were talking about there was a honeymooning couple from North Carolina. There was an Iranian guy. People seemed to have come from all over the world. And that's one of the things that really struck me, because we live in a world today where religious fundamentalism is on the rise. And then in the face of this, you have this atheist convention, which people should know, 2,500 people coming together for this convention from all over the world is a really remarkable thing. But how do you look at that in relation to this, you know, ongoing rise of religious fundamentalism in the world as the way to answer the contradictions and the problems that people are up against?
Well, we've got to put it in perspective, first of all. 2,500 people is pretty good, but if you go to a used car salesman convention, you'll find 10 times that many, and that will just be a regional convention. So in one sense, it's not that big yet. What it is a sign of things to come. And what we're seeing is that a lot of people are coming together because there is a strong reaction against religious fundamentalism, that many of the people there are very motivated because they see this idiocy going on in their homes, and they want to see it corrected. And the atheists are providing some leadership. We're saying we should live in a secular world. We should have secular rules in our government. We need to oppose things like fundamentalism. There should be no more wars fought for religion. Lots of simple, basic ideas like that that people can resonate with.
Of course, the atheists then need to have issued a statement from the convention to the Texas school board, who has apparently missed that message. So.
Well, that's another thing. You know, the Texas school board is not going to pay attention to a bunch of atheists. They aren't. But what we hope is that members of the Texas electorate will be listening and will do something to throw the rascals out the next election.
The press that was on this was really interesting. I mean, there was a lot of, it certainly was very controversial in among the Christians. The Christians were writing about it like crazy. But, you know, and also I saw one that was very interesting in terms of his description of the convention, where he described it as something, the largest gathering of people who should be afraid but are not afraid of a lightning bolt thrown in anger and vengeance.
We had the most beautiful weather in Melbourne while we were there. People actually commented on the fact that, you know, the week before there'd been some major hailstorm or something. So, no, God smiled upon us, I think.
Of course, there were a lot of frogs, and you're all going to get warts now. That'll be the problem.
No, we're all feeling pretty good, except maybe a little jet lag still.
Mm-hmm. What were some of the most significant things you found at the convention?
The most significant things I found, well, a couple of things just leapt out at me. And one is that this convention gave a lot of space and time to women's issues. So they're conscious of the fact that, that often in the past, women have been underrepresented in the atheist movement, and they're working to correct that, which I think is an important step. You know, having both sexes on board with us, good idea.
What are those issues?
Well, for instance, they talked about the oppression of women in fundamentalist countries. So this is, of course, a major issue. That you go to some place like Iraq or Iran or something, and what you find is this resurgence of old-time Muslim values, which means women get sequestered and they have to wear the funny clothes, and they're treated as third or fourth class citizens and so forth. So, of course, we've got a natural constituency right there with people who ought to be opposing religion.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because when you think about that, it's a lot of times I think people, especially in this country, and perhaps it's more sort of the U.S.-centric thinking or whatever, but the idea that atheists are not simply opposed to Christianity, but to all forms of religion, you know, and so I think this thing of actually bringing up this thing of Islamic fundamentalism, Wiccanism, whatever, you know, I was thinking of that when I was thinking about the intro to this, I was thinking, okay, well, we could call them pagans, and then I thought, no, what about the great and mighty Zog, you
know? Yes, the pagans drive us crazy, too, because, you know, there's a lot of New Age beliefs out there that that are unfounded in evidence and are really rather ridiculous. So, yeah, we hate them all.
Okay, you're my kind of people. Well, let's continue on with this thing about this. You said one of the most significant things was the involvement of women. What about the involvement of youth?
Yeah, we had young people there, but this, well, you know, that's a tough one. There were many students at the college level, but younger people, no, we didn't get so much of them. Mm-hmm. I spoke at the Freethought University Alliance, which is a new group that's forming up in Australia. It's kind of an umbrella organization to link up all the various godless groups at universities. It's a lot like the Secular Student Alliance in the United States. The universities are firing up, and lots of students are joining these groups. So we're at least getting that cohort on board. Mm-hmm. And also, that's one of the places where we find increasing involvement of women as well. So it all works together. Mm-hmm. Bringing in young people, being a little bit more lively and interesting, you get a more diverse group of people showing up at your meetings.
Well, now, what about, we talked about some of the significant things. What about some of the most controversial topics?
There were a few things. One thing is that I thought was very positive, but some people took as a negative, is this show was hilarious. They brought in lots of comedians. So every night, after you'd had all the heavy talks all day, you know, with people like Peter Singer and Anthony Grayling and so forth, then in the evening they would just have a slate of nothing but comedy. So Catherine Devaney, Jamie Kielstein, a whole bunch of people like that just get up there and made fun of religion and also made fun of atheism. We do not take ourselves that seriously.
What? You'll pay for that, my friend. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with P.Z. Myers, the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Pharyngula, and he's just returned for the Global Atheist Convention in Australia, and we're talking about that convention and the issues posed there. Now, P.Z., you know, one of the topics that came up, I think, in terms of controversy, was one that you spoke to on the convention floor, was the idea of the question, the debate around, can science and religion be compatible?
Correct.
What did you have to say about that?
Well, the first thing I said about it is I tried to address the most common criticism of that idea, and that is that many people say, well, of course they're compatible because we know scientists who go to church, which is absolutely absurd. I mean, that doesn't address the issue at all. So I made the point that, yeah, we also know people like serial murderers who go to church. That doesn't mean that Christianity and killing people are compatible. So what we have is a lot of scientists now who are fairly open about their religious beliefs, and that's just fine. But it doesn't mean that how you do science is compatible with how you do religion. When these religious scientists go into the lab, what they do is they turn off the religious part of their brain. They don't pray for good results. That doesn't work. What they do is use the good old secular, material, physical methods of science.
You know, that really fascinates me because having gone to, as I've mentioned to you before, having gone to a Catholic university and getting the best education that the 12th century had to offer and majoring in science, one of the things that really got me, though, is that it's true that to a certain extent you had to turn off this. And for me, there wasn't a religious part of my brain. I was actually there because they gave me lots of money to go. But it was sort of, and I had no principles at the time. But I remember studying this, the first microbiology course I took, and the textbook opened up with the idea that, okay, this is what we're going to go, we're going to start from where humanity is now and work our way back to the origins of the universe and life. And they got to a certain point, and at that point, everything closed down. They got back to the Big Bang, and instead of saying, we don't know, from this point on, we really don't know, but as time goes on and as our investigation goes on, we'll continue to explore and we'll learn more. Instead, they said, this is where the hand of the divine comes in.
Oh.
You know, and I was like, and to me, it was just sort of, I couldn't wait to get out of that school.
Right.
You know, well, it was that's amazing.
Basically admission, though, that the hand of the divine is another word for we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But here's the question, because you've had a lot of exchange and discourse with, who's it, Ken Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the idea that people, is it really possible, do you think, for people to turn off that religious section of their brain in terms of what they actually think? It seems to me it's very difficult to separate something ideologically that's so deep in you. And then when you're exploring the world using science and really dependent on taking up materialism.
Well, I think people are actually very good at that. That, you know, we all have fairly diverse personalities and things that we like. You know, at the beginning of the show, you mentioned singing along. Do you start singing when you do science? It's really not. In most cases, it's not an issue because we've set everything up so they're not in direct conflict. It's only in these certain venues where you bring it up that suddenly you see it in conflict. That what we see, for instance, is that that religion tends to shut down questioning, mm-hmm. like you mentioned. You know, it says, here's our explanation for the Big Bang. It was the hand of the divine. That's a science stopper.
Mm-hmm.
But in other areas, the Catholic Church has moved beyond that. And they said, okay, well, you know, there's all these fossils out there. We got to have an explanation for them. It's not in the Bible. We will turn to science. And it works out all right.
In my case, it was one of the things that was interesting is that it turned me to, I still pursued a degree in biology, but I also ended up getting a degree in philosophy. You know, because it really forced me to actually question what the hell is going on here. And then, of course, in philosophy, then turned me into a Marxist. There you go. And that's where I am today.
Yeah.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with P.Z. Myers, biologist and assistant professor at the University of Minnesota, Morris. And he's also the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Pharyngula. Boy, that's just a lot of fun to say that name, Pharyngula. And we're talking about the Global Atheist Convention that was recently held in Melbourne, Australia. I have a big question for you. One of the more controversial facts that was reported, and I just want to know if this was true or not. Did you, in fact, have lunch with Beelzebub?
I don't know. That Australian beer is really potent, so I kind of blurred out around there. But yeah.
I saw some videos of it, and it was a strange-looking character kept walking through that.
Well, there was a guy dressed as Jesus there, too, so apparently we could argue that Jesus was blessing the conference.
And they had a WrestleMania SmackDown match, okay? All right. One of the things you also spoke to, and I found this very interesting, is you spoke to the, when you talked about this Free Thought University Alliance that talk that you gave to these youth, you mentioned a number of points to them, and I thought they were really interesting points. You said, don't get old, organize, debate and wrestle with ideas as the lifeblood of the movement, lead and be bold and rude.
You know? Yes.
Can you talk about what you were talking about there, what you were trying to say to the youth there?
Well, what I was trying to tell them is what they've got to do, you know, that there's this idea you join the club and you just kind of sit around and you talk. But I think one of the things we have to do is be more confrontational. We have to get out there and talk to people more. So what I'm doing is trying to urge them to be a little bit more ferocious, to be unafraid and get out there and engage in intellectual discussions with people. And, you know, just I also told them, have a good time. That one of the ways we keep people interested in the group is you recognize that there's more to the world than just fighting with your neighbors. You also have fun with them. And so I told them, party down as well. And yeah, be rude to the Christians and the Muslims and all that.
Well, you were saying that. I mean, what I found interesting is you were saying that in terms of this being rude, exactly in terms of getting people to wrestle with the most difficult questions posed. Which, I mean, to me, it really captured a lot of the essence of what you were saying earlier in this discussion of the idea that wrestling with ideas and wrestling with thoughts and analysis of the world is sort of becoming the lifeblood of this movement, or needs to be the lifeblood of any kind of atheist movement.
Yes, it is. One of the phrases I really dislike, have you ever heard the phrase, agree to disagree?
Yeah, it's too many times.
it's a very stupid sort of thing to say. What it's saying is, yeah, we have deep differences, but we will not discuss them. We will let them slide. And no, we're not going to do that anymore. We do not agree to disagree. We disagree, and we are going to fight about it. Fight about it in a rhetorical sense, of course. So
except
yeah,
for Jesus and Beelzebub, who had that SmackDown, right?
Right.
Uh-huh. One question is, that point about not going for the agree to disagree, actually that gets back to the science and religion concept too, because here's a thing. I mean, you know, Stephen Jay Gould was actually one of the points that really disappointed me was when he said, we'll leave to religion the things that are religions, and then we'll leave to science the things that are science. And to me, that was sort of an agree to disagree. You're not going to whack religion out of everybody's head. You know, there's a process of people coming to understand the world. I think everything that you guys were saying at this convention that you've argued for a good deal of your life is the idea that there's evidence and materialism and reality-based thinking and rational world, you know, and that's something that people have to come to through, again, this wrestling of ideas, public wrestling of ideas. But this idea of leaving science its things and religion its things, what do you have to say about that?
I was very disappointed in Gould in that one, too. For instance, what he says is that what we ought to leave to religion is issues of why we're here and morality and things like that, that they're supposed to be the leaders in that. But in case you haven't noticed, religion has done a very poor job of leading in morality, pedophile scandals and so forth. What we see is that religion doesn't seem to guarantee any kind of higher ethical sense at all. All it does is foster tribalism and pretend that that's morality. And so, no, I think he failed completely there. That religion doesn't seem to do much of anything at all, if you think about it, except encourage that kind of in-group, out-group distinction and foster all kinds of arguments that are very stupid. You know, why should Protestants and Catholics fight? Mm-hmm. They both believe pretty much the same thing. It's little tiny differences of doctrine that, again, are completely unfounded in evidence. Why should they bicker over that? Mm-hmm. There's much deeper things to fight over.
Yeah, exactly. And actually, one of the things that this will be, have to be the last question, but we're really fighting to get this on a regular monthly basis. So April, you're going to be here. One of the things that I wanted to talk about is, and it follows right off of that, this idea, one of the things you wrote about and seemed to be really kind of, I thought, a very important point, that ethics and morality are not the property of religion. And that people a lot of times look at if you're atheist, you're actually amoral, which is a very, very, I mean, to me, that's the way the Christians pose that. And to me, your answer to that is very compelling. Can you speak to that?
Well, the answer to that is, first of all, you can just look at atheists. We all behave in moral ways, and in some ways we seem to be a little better at it than the religious people. But again, what do you have in religion other than absolute rules? People dictating to you what you have to do and you obey them. If you want to talk about ethics and morality, the proper domain for that discussion is philosophy. Philosophy actually offers a lot of serious discussion and contemplation about ethics and morality without doing it by taking a shortcut and saying, well, God says this is what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Very good, very good. PZ, thank you very much for joining us today.
Yes, let's talk again next month.
Yeah, definitely, man. Take care, and looking forward to talking to you again.
Yeah.
Bye now.
Bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We've just been talking with PZ Myers, one of the leading atheists in the world and the author of the most popular science blog in the world, Pharyngula. And if you just Google PZ Myers, Pharyngula is the first thing that comes up. So you don't even have to know how to spell it. PZ Myers. Okay, and then you'll get Pharyngula. And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be speaking with Clyde Young from Revolution Newspaper. And we'll be talking about the banning of Revolution Newspaper in the Pelican Bay prison in California.
Too many morning, gotta wake up soon. Oh, Lord, I need my breakfast by the light of the moon. Oh, Lord, by the light of the moon. If you see my mama, tell her this for me. Oh, I've got a mighty long time. Lord knows I'll never go free. Oh, Lord, I'll never be free. Last summer when I got my time,
Angola bound.
For my ball, they got 100, I got 99.
Angola bound.
You've been a long time coming.
Welcome back. That was the voice of Aaron Neville doing Angola Bound. Really beautiful song. Got lucky when he got his time. His partner got 100, he got 99.
Yeah.
Never going to be free, he's Angola Bound. Joining me today to talk about prison repression, the banning of Revolution Newspaper from Pelican Bay Prison in California, and also from Menard Prison in Illinois. Is Clyde Young from Revolution Newspaper and the Revolutionary Communist Party. Clyde, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Sure. Well, why don't we tell people right off the bat, the front page of the current issue of Revolution Newspaper announces that this paper has been banned in those two places.
Yes.
What actually is the situation? Can you fill in some of the details of that?
Yes. Well, this situation came to our attention in February of this year with a letter from Pelican Bay. So Pelican Bay is one of the prisons that this newspaper has been banned in, and as you said, also Menard, Illinois. And they basically had, the letter basically indicated that two things. One is that the newspaper basically, as it says here, that the newspaper, if I can read from this, it says that the newspaper has been described by Pelican Bay as promoting disruption and the overthrow of the government and incites violence, to do so. And it also later talked about, I don't know if it was a separate letter or whatever, but it later talked about how the newspaper incites racial violence between the prisoners. So this is basically the essence of it. And this came to us in February, but as we learn, the ban and labeling of the newspaper as contraband has been going on for some time, going back to last fall.
So in other words, actually prisoners, I had read somewhere, I think in the article, that prisoners were just not getting the newspaper and had no idea what had happened. Some of them thought their subscription had elapsed that the Prisoners' Revolutionary Literature Fund, which is one of the agencies that actually gets this revolutionary literature into the prisons, that it had just run out of money or something. But there was never any idea that this is what was behind this, that it was this official ban coming down, this official repression.
That's exactly right. We didn't know that, as I said, until we got the letters in February. Mm-hmm. And then at that time, we began to learn through letters to the PRLLF, the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund, I should state their full name, that prisoners wrote to the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund indicating that they had not been receiving issues of the paper dating back to October of 2009.
Let's dig into this. Now, there's a couple ways I wanted to get at this, but one of the things is that, look, Revolution Newspaper, and before that, the Revolutionary Worker, have been getting into prisons, and particularly prisons in California and Pelican Bay, mm-hmm. for quite some time. I mean, this has been a long-standing distribution of the paper in prisons all across the country.
Yes.
What is it? Why now do you think that it suddenly has become the issue to be banned?
That's a very good question. As you know, in July of last year, 2009, we released a statement from the Revolutionary Communist Party entitled, "The Revolution We Need, the Leadership That We Have." And in conjunction with that statement, Jovill of the Revolutionary Communist Party actually wrote a statement to prisoners calling on them to basically speak to these youth out here in these streets who are caught up in all kinds of foolishness. And even more than that, to speak more broadly to people in society about not only the revolution we need, but also the leadership, the precious leadership and unique leadership that we have in Bob Avakian. And after that, a wave of letters start coming in from prisoners, and maybe we can get to some of those letters later. But those letters were truly inspiring. And in fact, you can, one thing that's important to emphasize is that these letters are really a lifeline. The newspaper is a lifeline to the prisoners, and these letters are a lifeline to people out in society, broadly in society, not only people, youth caught up in these various things out in the streets, but also to middle-class people, to professors, and to everybody. These letters are truly inspiring that are coming from prisoners based on reading Revolution newspaper.
Well, we'll get into the letters and sort of the role of the paper and the importance of that in a few minutes. I wanted to ask you a couple of other questions, though, because it was also one of the papers, one of the issues that seems to have caught their ire is there was a special issue of Revolution on prisons and on prisons in America and the situation that's facing people and how this plays out. I mean, you have, when you think about it, you have, what is it, 1 in 9 black men in prison in America? And you have, you know, half the, if you have a population of 2 million people in jail, you have half of them, almost half of them, are black people.
Yes.
You know, and this is an incredibly, incredibly oppressive and damning situation. So was this one of the issues that was banned?
Yes, this was one of the issues that prisoners have written to the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund, and for short, PRLF, indicating that they didn't receive. And this is a really sort of a an exposure of the prison system itself, that they would ban this particular issue of the paper, which, first of all, what it's doing is it's talking about telling the truth about the conditions that exist in this country. But more than that, I think you can get something important from the title of this newspaper, which is from the hellholes of incarceration to a future of emancipation. And I think what that's getting to is very important, because it's saying that all these prisoners who've been cast off and put into these dungeons and in many cases locked up in places like Pelican Bay, you know, in very extreme conditions where they're locked up 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, that they actually have the potential to transform, not only to transform, but to become emancipators of humanity. And that's what this newspaper revolution is actually trying to do, and is actually speaking to these prisoners, not as people who have been just cast off and forgotten and are just, you know, basically have no use to society as a whole, but actually that they actually can transform and become emancipators of humanity. That's the important message that prisoners are getting from this paper. And in fact, that was part of the title of the issue that prisoners didn't get last October.
Now, one of the things, you yourself spent quite a bit of your youth in prison.
Yes.
And you led a rebellion in prison, and you became a revolutionary communist in prison.
Yes.
What was the importance of getting revolutionary literature as a way of getting people, giving people some kind of understanding of what difference it makes in a prisoner's life to get revolutionary literature? And then we can talk about revolution in particular and its impact. But first, let's talk about, you, speaking from your own experience, what difference did it make to you to have revolutionary literature available?
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, thinking back on my own experience, and it's not, actually it's worse today than it was when I was in prison because of the massive incarceration of prisoners and warehousing of them, and essentially labeling them as basically as having no use for society whatsoever. But back when I was in prison, you know, I went in for, you know, a robbery when I was 17 years old and had a 20-year sentence, and I had no interest whatsoever in politics. But as I got in there and began to be influenced by the Black Panther Party and others, I began to take up revolutionary literature, including the works of Marx, Lenin, and Mao. And that actually transformed me. It was very important to me. Had I not had that type of, you know, outlet and had that kind of information coming in, and, you know, I probably wouldn't have transformed in the way that I transformed. But also, too, that was against the backdrop of a revolutionary movement that existed in the country at that time. So all these influences played a tremendous role in actually transforming me into the revolutionary communist that I am today.
I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're talking today with Clyde Young from Revolutionary Communist Party and Revolution Newspaper about the banning of Revolution Newspaper in the Pelican Bay Prison in California and the Menard Prison in Illinois. Now, Clyde, one of the things when you were talking, I couldn't help but think about this point of, you know, some of the letters that come out in the from the prisoners, where they talk about things that you really get a sense of and I think one that Joe Veal wrote to prisoners,
yes,
where he talked,
yes,
about his experience in Leavenworth, where,
yes,
he was actually, and he said, and it was a very moving letter, yeah, because he says that they were, you know, he was in the hole, and he was 23,
yeah,
and it was a friend of his was 19,
yes,
and they were debating Plato. And that all of a sudden his friend, as they're talking about this, all of a sudden his friend starts laughing really loud, really, you know, joyfully, but then, mm-hmm, says, Joe says, what are you laughing at? And, mm-hmm, he says, well, here we are, the worst of the worst, the ones that society has said, man, these people just should be put in a box and shoved into a drawer and,
right,
forgotten about.
Right.
You know, and essentially that's what they do when they put you,
right,
in the hole, basically.
Right.
And he ended up saying that and here we are debating what these philosophers, Plato and Socrates, how they have nothing but suffering for the people and are linked to the system of oppression as it existed at that time and has been used ever since. And you think about, and I keep thinking about some of these other letters that come from prisoners,
yeah,
you know, where people talk about the importance of being able to take on the biggest questions that are in society. There's people who talked about taking on the Christian fascists in prison, you know, that religion is just propagated and promoted. How do you take this on? People asking for the evolution books.
Yes.
So these, can you give people a sense of these letters?
Yes. These letters, first of all, the one that you just cited or referred to by Joe Veal was actually truly inspiring. And people can get that on YouTube by just, you know, going to YouTube and searching for his name, Joe Veal. And I think it's important for a lot of people to see that. But you have prisoners writing in talking about how they're truly amazed by science. I mean, this is one of the letters that I, you know, read in New York at the program with Cornel West and Carl Dix. You have women writing in and talking about the conditions of women within prison. But another letter that I referred to in New York was that someone writes in and say that you have a gold mine in Bob Avakian in terms of what he actually represents and his ability to actually speak to millions of people. But you also have prisoners who have written in about the campaign that we're conducting, the revolution we need, the leadership we have, and speaking quite eloquently to the necessity of what they've been learning from that about the nature of the system, but also at the same time speaking to people outside the walls about the importance of taking up this campaign. And, you know, maybe we can get to one of those letters later on, but they're truly inspiring. You know, there's, mm-hmm, a number of them that I was looking over this morning, and people have commented on this, of how inspiring they were. Mm-hmm. These letters have been read at benefits for the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund, and people have, you know, and they've been performed by actors, at really bringing to life and bringing alive the words of these prisoners. In fact, I attended one in Houston not that long ago, one of these benefits for the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund, where you had actors. I mean, it's difficult to even describe how powerful that the readings of these letters actually were.
Let me ask you, because we're on a tight thing. We have about 8 minutes, I think, left, or seven minutes. And I wanted to ask you this. You mentioned the language in the letters that were mm-hmm. that were shown, that you received, that was received by the paper and by the prisoners.
Yeah.
And by the paper, there was a point, it said something, what did it say? It said something about condoning violence and the overthrow of the government or something?
Yes.
And you know, and then to the prisoners, it talked about anarchy, promoting anarchy and racial violence.
Yes.
Can we talk about those two things? Because I'm sitting here and I'm thinking, these people are out of their minds,
yes,
man.
Right,
you know, but
right,
let's
right.
talk about both, because it's also very serious what they're trying to, the precedent they're trying to establish here.
Well, first of all, I think the first thing, the fact that this newspaper actually promotes revolution is constitutionally protected. That's the first thing that I think is important to establish. And as the newspaper itself indicates, this issue of the newspaper indicates that this ban on the newspaper is both illegal, unconstitutional, and immoral. Now, the second part of what you were asking has to do with, you know, the violence behind the walls. Now, you know, there's everybody knows that basically the prison authorities, and this is from my own experience from being in prison, they actually foment these divisions between the races. And today they foment those kinds of differences between the gangs. When you go into prison, you're already hooked up. If you're black, you're with all the blacks, and then you can sort that out in terms of what gang you're actually hooked up with. If you're white, you're with the whites automatically. So there's a way in which, can we not remember or recall the Corcoran Shoe, where prisoners were actually, you know, in gladiator style, you know, the violence was, I mean, basically the prison guards were telling these prisoners different things and stirring them up to the point of, you know, intense anger, and then releasing them from their cells and letting them fight, sometimes almost to death. And this is something that actually in the center page of the newspaper on prisons and prisoners that Bob Avakian referred to, and then at the same time was calling on people to look at how there could be a different world. So these are things that are actually legendary, how the prison guards actually stir up these types of divisions among the prisoners. And I think the most glaring example of that is the Corcoran Shoe, where they actually had prisoners fighting one another in gladiator style.
Let me ask you this, because I think when I think about this, and you know, whenever I think about this issue of the revolutionary literature and revolution newspaper in the prisons, I think about the statement from the Attica brothers mm-hmm. when they issued their list of demands and how they opened up their call and they said, "We are human beings and we demand to be treated as mm-hmm. such." You know, and there's a whole role in terms of if you think about the fullness of human life and the fullness of human participation in changing the world. You know, and that's really what's being taken away from prisoners when you take away something like Revolution Newspaper. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's really, I think you spoke to it a little bit earlier about the, you know, it's both what's going on, you know, what you get people being able to wrestle mm-hmm. with the ideas in prison, but also the impact, not just people hearing their voices and the impact that the prisoners can have as part of the larger society and the larger struggle. Mm-hmm. What would you say about actually the importance, the strategic importance of prisoners in this situation today in relation to this Revolution Newspaper?
Well, this is extremely important because you hear all the propaganda against prisoners. You hear the Bill Cosbys and you hear the Obamas talking about how basically people need to pull their pants up and ultimately, they're condemning and attacking people who are at the base of society, who are forced into circumstances that they didn't create themselves. And then they get sent off and warehoused in the prison. And there is this atmosphere that exists in society that these people have nothing to contribute whatsoever. I thought what you were describing about the letter from Joville is a prime example of that, how they were talking about Plato down in solitary confinement, and they were saying they were the worst of the worst. But here they were not only discussing, but actually critiquing Plato. Well, I think this, you know, these letters give people a sense that not only are these prisoners human, but they actually are able to grapple with the biggest ideas that have to do with making and changing the world and making a whole new world, that they can grapple with these things and they can contribute in very powerful ways to the development of a revolutionary movement and to the development of a whole new society. People get that from these letters.
Mm-hmm. And including, actually, their thoughts and their struggle and their wrestling with ideas and yes. their strategic, you know, thinking and stuff, becoming part of the general struggle in society,
yes.
and, you know, going out of the prisons.
Yes, exactly.
You know, in terms of the communication it gets with the paper and the yes. voices being brought out there, I think is extremely important. What can people do about this banning of the paper, Revolution Newspaper?
That's a very important question. And I think what we need is, first of all, this banning cannot stand. There has to be a massive political and legal movement mounted against this ban against the paper in the prisons in Pelican Bay. And it may be that it's broader than just Pelican Bay. We have to investigate that and find out. But one thing people can do is to basically support the work of the Prisoner Revolutionary Literature Fund. And I wanted to give their address where people can write. And I'll repeat it twice. One is that they can write to prlf_fund@yahoo.com. That's prlf_fund@yahoo.com. But also, too, I think as part of this overall thing, we need to geometrically expand the distribution of this paper behind the walls of prison and to develop a whole movement that's actually aimed at overturning this ban and getting this, not only getting this paper back into prison, but actually, as I said, geometrically expanding it, as well as part of this overall process, further moving forward the objectives of the campaign that we launched last July, the revolution we need, the leadership we have.
Do you have, real quick, we have about a minute and a half, do you have a particular letter you'd like to read?
Yes.
Okay. Let's do that. And okay.
Usually I have these memorized, but you know I haven't had time to do that. And if you give me one more second,
sure. I can always sing while you're doing this.
Yes, you can. Okay, here's one. It says, "Revolution began to open my eyes to a whole other way that society could be organized and a whole other way of thinking. Instead of focusing intently on revenge and my own personal oppression or wrongs, I began to see that this capitalist imperialist system is fundamentally based on the exploitation and oppression of the vast majority of humanity at the hands of the few within the ruling class who own and control the means of production. and that the basis exists to emancipate all of humanity from the oppressive relations of class society and unleash people to flourish in ways undreamed of under the confines of this capitalist system. There is a deep desire among prisoners broadly to understand the world. Revolution Newspaper is a vital resource that not just allows prisoners to understand the world, but to become part of changing it as they change themselves, to become part of putting revolution and communism back on the map, to popularize the path-breaking work in re-envisioning communism by Bob Avakian has done, and to bring forward a core of people dedicated to building this revolutionary movement. That's an example of one of the letters from prisoners.
Now, is there a way people can get hold of you if they want to get hold of you?
Yes, they can reach me at young_Clyde@yahoo.com.
That's young_Clyde@yahoo.com. Clyde, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Okay. Yeah. And you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we are going to take a short break. We've been talking with Clyde Young from Revolution Newspaper about the banning of Revolution Newspaper in Pelican Bay Prison and Menard Prison in Illinois and the fight to overturn that ban. And we're going to take a short break and be right back speaking with Age from the L.A. Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant in the October 22nd Coalition and Jack Bryson, a family friend of the Grants and whose sons were on the platform with Oscar when he was murdered. Take a short break and be right back.
Shade of my skin, only head color to my tears. That splash against my hollow bones that rocks my soul. Looking back over my past dreams that I once knew. Came true. Somebody tell me, what can I do? Something is holding me back. Is that because I'm black?
Welcome back. That was Ken Booth with a really powerful song, Is It Because I'm Black? This is a remarkable song from an equally remarkable album called Darker Than Blue, Soul from Jam Down 1973 to 1980. Now you should think about this song while you're listening to this next segment of the show. People should think about that song and about the perception you have and then think about that song even more. And we're here now to talk to you about the concrete reality of the conception of what's going on with that, that people do get murdered because they're black. Okay, that's what happens to people in this society. Case in point, Oscar Grant, a young black man murdered up in Oakland, California by a Bay Area rapid transit cop, Johannes Messerly, on January 1st, 2009, in front of hundreds of witnesses. The cop was eventually arrested and charged with murder, and the courts ordered the cop's trial moved from Oakland to Los Angeles. The trial is due to start sometime in early June.
And joining us to talk about this today is Jack Bryson, a friend of the Grant family, who's Oscar Grant family, who, and for people who don't know, you should know. And boy, you should be ashamed if you don't know, okay? Go and find out. Oscar Grant murdered by Johannes Messerly, a BART cop, the Bay Area Rapid Transit cop, on January 1st, 2009, simply for being black, okay? He was laid out on the platform and shot. Okay, and Messerly's trial is opening up in L.A. in June, and that's what we're here to talk about. And Jack Bryson's a friend of the Grant family whose sons were on the platform with Oscar when he was murdered. We also have Age from the October 22nd Coalition and the L.A. Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant. Jack, let's start with you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your son's on the platform.
Correct.
Tell us what you know about what happened with Oscar, what your sons have told you, what's going on. What happened to your sons, too?
These young men were approached by these BART police officers with guns, tasers, and when they got off the BART train, they were approached, and these young men were asking them, what are we being approached about? And they were told to, I don't know if I can cuss, they were told to shut the blah, blah, blah up, or we'll shoot you in the blah, blah face, sit down on FFF ground, And if you look at the video, these young men complied with everything these police officers told them.
People should go see that video. You want to see cold-blooded murder. That's what you'll see there.
Execution.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Now, your sons have also come under police scrutiny and basically been terrorized by the police since then, right?
Yeah, they've been pulled over quite frequently. And my oldest son, he's been arrested and put in jail a couple of times. And then, every time he's arrested, they run his face through the news. The young man that was with Oscar Grant is in jail, but they don't know both sides of the story.
Then they also did a thing where they said, didn't they say something, they tried to insinuate that your son was actually offering some justification for what the cop did?
That's how they put it. Mm-hmm. But we knew this a year ago. What happened is after Oscar Grant was murdered, these young men were arrested and they weren't even arrested. They were just brought to the police station. They were left in the cars for 2 hours. And then they were left in the jail cells for 4 hours. And they started questioning these young men and putting fear in them. Whereas the police officers were questioned a week later and given the video to review. So the cover-up started that night. So these young men were scared. They said nothing to hurt it. And then they tried to run with it. And Don C. Clay, when we were going to the pretrial, he told Michael Raines, the attorney, that whatever Jackie Bryson heard doesn't matter because Jackie Bryson does not know what was going through Johannes Mesley's head. Only Johannes Mesley knows why he murdered Oscar Grant.
Well, that's the thing, is that you think about this. And to me, the whole, even what you just said about the way that and everybody knows, man, if you're in jail and you're a young guy and you're in jail and you're a young black guy, a lot of things going through your head, including the fact that you may not walk out of the jail.
Exactly.
Especially after you just seen your good friend
exactly.
executed on the platform.
Exactly.
And this kind of thing of trying to use, whatever, and creating statements or using statements or whatever, or mixing people up, and then trying to use that, float that out. And again, this came out in a civil case, and so they started to float it out in a way that could actually influence some of the criminal trial, right?
That's what they're trying to do, and they're trying to make these young men into the criminals when they're not. And, we got a victory yesterday. The police officer that was in charge of the platform that night, she was fired yesterday.
I was going to ask you about that. Yes, tell me about that.
She was fired. When these young men, when we were in court, this woman, she said when she got to the platform, she knew that they was going to have to kill somebody before this even started. And the judge stopped. He said, wait a minute. Who were you going to kill? And she said, one of these young men. And the judge, why? Because we were being attacked by hundreds of people. So the judge said, show the video. And he said, I want you to tell me to stop when you see these hundreds of people. There was none. It was Oscar Grant, Jackie Bryson, Nigel Bryson, June, Michael Greer, and Carlos. They all had their hands up, and they were handcuffed. And he asked, you were going to shoot one of these young men for what? And she was fired yesterday. And Tony Peroni's next. We got victories behind this, in the community uproar. The DA who's been there for like 30 years, Tom Orloff, he resigned. Chief G resigned, who began the cover-up. Johannes Mesley was arrested for murder and jail. And then yesterday, we got a police officer fired. So as a community, we did this. So we are getting victories,
On the other hand, there's a lot at stake here for this system because you're putting one of their cops on trial for murder. This is, and actually, Age has made this point a number of times where he talked about this is the first time in the history of the state of California where a cop was put on trial for murder on duty.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that's going up against a whole lot because if this happens, I think that they are very concerned about how far are they going to have to go around this. And I think what you're saying is true in terms of people, when people stood up and people are still facing, this is the other side of that. People are still facing charges off of the rebellions that happened in the aftermath of Oscar's murder, right?
Well, JR, his charges got dropped. Mm-hmm. His charges got dropped, mm-hmm. So that was a victory right there for JR. He was challenging the system. They wanted to give him 3 years. He said he wasn't going to take 3 years and he challenged it.
You're listening to the Michael Slate Show and we're talking about the Oscar Grant case. Oscar was an unarmed young black man murdered by the Bay Area Rapid Transit Police, the BART Police, on January 1st, 2009. Now, this murder occurred in Oakland, California, and scores of videos were taken of the murder by other passengers on the train that night, each one showing way beyond any possible doubt that this cop, Johannes Mesley, executed Oscar Grant in cold blood while the young man was laid out face down on the train platform. Over the last year and a half, millions of people here and around the world have seen this video and know what happened. The cop's trial has been moved to Los Angeles and will open up in early June. We're talking today with Age from the October 22nd Coalition and the Los Angeles Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant, and Jack Bryson, whose two sons were with Oscar when he was murdered.
Let me ask Age a question. Now, Age, you've been involved in this. Now, you and you know, you've been a longtime member of the October 22nd Coalition, mm-hmm. and you were at the heart of pulling together this Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant here in L.A. How are you guys looking at this? How should people be looking at this in L.A.? Like I said, if you've seen that video, you know what happened there, and you got to stand up and, you know, you actually have to, you have to really examine your thinking if you're not completely, utterly outraged and moved by what you see in this. And you guys have, how are you guys looking at this whole situation?
Well, here in Los Angeles, we're looking at this as something that, I mean, you know, in this city, we see things like what happened to Oscar. We see Oscar Grants on a daily basis here. In this last week, we've seen several reports and news from different people being killed around Los Angeles, whether it was the autistic brother, unarmed autistic brother who got killed by LAPD, I believe. There was a man killed by the Gardena police the other day. You know, the Michael Bayoun case, the Inglewood police just had to settle for $2.5 million for shooting Michael Bayoun and his friend. Even though they gave up the money, they still protected their officers, and who, you know, they gave that $2.5. But they still let the police officer stay on the force, who ended up being the same one who killed Kevin Wicks a couple weeks later. You know, we see these things happening all the time. We know that Oscar Grant could be any one of us. And so we very much think this is, we are determined to get justice in this case. This is, it's so rare that we even have a real, you know, a real opportunity to get victories and to see police officers be held accountable for the vicious crimes they commit in our communities. And when we have an opportunity like this, it is of utmost importance that we all stand up together and make sure that they have no choice but to give us justice.
At the same time, Oscar, I know what you're saying. It's true. And that's an element of us. We are all Oscar Grant. But then there's also a concentration of what happened to Oscar. There's a concentration of the oppression of black people by this system in what happened to Oscar Grant. You know, and to me, there's actually, you know, people got to deal with that to a certain extent, you know, and actually even this, I was looking at this, you talked about this autistic brother. I don't know if you guys heard about this.
Yeah. Four and 3 days.
Yeah. Well, this guy was last Saturday, he was walking down the street and the cops said they heard a bang. Mm-hmm. They were headed in the opposite direction. They turned around to come back and they said he didn't respond and he kept walking towards them. And then he seemed to be reaching. We thought he seemed to be reaching for what we thought seemed to be a gun. You know, there's so many seams and thoughts and all this other stuff. And they killed him, both of them shot, and he died from a bullet wound in the head. Now you think about this. This is what happens with Oscar, is if they get away with absolute blatant murder, you know, think about what that's saying, okay. This execution. What, we have about 2 minutes left, so what are the plans here now? You're both in town. You're in town, Jack, and you're actually heading down to the courthouse today. Mm-hmm. There's something going on today. And what's the plan? Because the trial starts what, June 6th?
June 7th. 7th,
okay.
June 7th is the actual trial date, the criminal trial of Johannes Meserle is going to start across California. We're going to stand up. We're not going to let them, you know, hide this case. So please, we're urging everybody to come out. Let's keep moving forward with this. We need to get justice.
How can people get hold of the LA Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant?
People can call us at area code 323-446-7459. You can also find the LA Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant on Facebook, on Twitter. There's a MySpace. If you do the search for LA Coalition for Justice for Oscar Grant.
All right, we're going to have to wrap it up. Jack, thank you very much for joining us today. Age, thank you for joining us today. Think about this. The world cries out like it never has in history for deep radical change. It's up to you what happens and what we get out of that. You've got to make your voice heard. Raise your voice. Make your voice heard and be part of actually bringing in a whole new future. I'm Michael Slate, and you can write to me at michaelslate@redfuture.com. I want to thank my engineer, Melissa Figueroa. I want to thank Age and Jack Bryson.
I also want to thank Clyde Young and P.Z. Myers. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. I'll be back to talk with you again next week. Until then, remember, the world we live in today is not the only way it can be. And once we understand that, we open up the doorway to the possibility of a whole different way of life.
And we're going to go out now with a song from Baby Huey called Listen to Me.
listen to me.